You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is someday in either February or March. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live-ish in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Ladies and gentlemen, I don't know what day it is. I'm not even 100% sure what month it is. Could be March. Could be February. Probably March. So what am I doing here? Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not here. We have pre-recorded this intro in the event that, well, not in the event, for when the inevitable event of the birth of my second child takes place. And because you're hearing it, it means that I am on paternity leave. How long will it be? Probably not that long. I may take a little more time later, but for the next day or two or three or four, maybe five, depending on which day you're listening to this, we will have a series of either guest hosts or pre-recorded interviews that we've done or archive shows. And in just a moment, you will hear the dulcet tones of Matt and Michael, the Majority Report producers, who will explain whether it's a guest host or some archived interviews from the first Majority Report or from this version of the Majority Report or interviews that I pre-recorded over the past couple of weeks or interviews done by some of my friends. Not to say that Michael and Matt aren't my friends. I'm friendly with them. But let's not get carried away. So I leave it now to Matt and Michael to give you the information. They'll tell you what the date is. They'll tell you what the status is of the birth of my second child. And they'll let you know what to expect on today's program. So see you soon.
It is March 11th, Monday, March 11th, 2013. I'm Michael Brooks.
And I'm Matt Binder.
We are those cordial acquaintances of Sam Cedar filling in for Sam as he takes on his new baby who has been named.
Yes, but would you email just a cordial acquaintance to give them your newborn baby's name? I think we're a little bit more than just cordial acquaintances.
I think Sam was lying. I'm being honest. I only consider him a cordial acquaintance.
All right. Well, the baby does have a name, and that baby's name is Saul Arthur Cedar.
You heard it here, folks. Saul Arthur Cedar. Let me see if I can do this properly because I
find
think
that shofar.
Yeah.
Kid's initials is SAS. A little bit of sass.
Probably will have some sass, I guess would be. I actually came around to it. I thought for a while that Saul was kind of I just thought it was a name of a different generation. But
I still think it is a name of a different generation.
I think that kid though, I think that there's a certain hipster demographic, which my guess will be he might fit into as he ages, as he goes into high school and college. And I think for that demographic, that Saul will work. It will have cred. It will be considered cool, kind of interesting and offbeat.
I don't know. I was really pulling for Obi, Anakin, Jar Jar, Solo, Cedar.
Right. So as you can see, Matt basically thinks that kids should be named after Star Wars characters, which means that...
Multiple Star Wars characters. Darth Cedar would have worked well, too.
Oh, my God. If you actually do that and we're still in touch down the road, I will call the Department of Social Services on you.
All right. That sounds good.
I promise. Now, me, when I have Malik Shabazz Brooks, that obviously...
Okay, I think it's time to get to the interview.
It's time to get to the interview, folks. This is an interview I did a couple of weeks ago with Reza Aslan, who's an external fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's also just an all-around, really bright Middle East analyst. And this is done a couple of weeks ago, so it was in the context of the Hegel nomination. But we got to what Hegel might mean for the broader Middle East and Iran. So we're going to run that interview right after the break, and then we will be back with the rest of the show. Thanks for tuning in. We celebrate like I finished probation, boy, boy. Not tag with no chaser, boy, boy. For the mouth, I can spit out a razor, boy, boy. Open up your facial like your boy, boy. In his prime, eat food, dinner time. Junior gong, pass the Guinness. Handle business, black velvet, sippers. Females never bid us, throw well, they with us. Cause we arrive on a scene just like a high beam, nah, I mean. Don't let us have to make the nine scream, nah, I mean. At your racial policing regime, nah, I mean. Spiritual well like an Elohim, nah, I mean. In a casino or a yacht, wherever I'm seen. My brothers and sisters are never forgotten, nah, I mean. Don't want to hear another soldier drop, nah, I mean. Another dope. And now, here's that interview I did with Reza Aslan. Just a couple weeks ago. We'll be back in about 20 minutes or so.
Hi, I'm Michael Brooks, and I'm filling in for Sam Cedar. And joining me now is Reza Aslan. He's a senior adjunct fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. How are you doing, Reza? Good to be talking with you.
I'm doing very well. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, my pleasure. So I want to get into the Hegel nomination. We're kind of mid sort of farce right now, and maybe by the time this interview is airing, the he will already have been confirmed. But we're mid sort of pseudo filibuster right now, I guess. Republicans are filibustering him, but basically acknowledging that he will eventually be confirmed. But you have a recent column where I think if you kind of step back from some of the sort of theater of what's happening, the nomination of Chuck Hagel represents some really significant things in terms of possible shifts in U.S. foreign policy. And I'm wondering if you could elaborate on that a little bit.
Well, I mean, obviously, there's a lot of reasons why some of the Republicans seem to have a problem with Chuck Hagel's nomination as Secretary of Defense. Some have made a big cause about his anti-nuclear proliferation stance, the fact that he was, until quite recently, a board member of the Plowshares Fund, where I, to be fair, am also a board member, nuclear nonproliferation group. Some have made a big deal about the fact that he has talked about a possibility of containment when it comes to Iran and direct negotiations. He's also called, as you know, for negotiations with Hezbollah and Hamas, which in the United States apparently is some kind of sin, even though the Israeli government negotiates with both of them on a regular basis. But to be perfectly frank, as I think most of your listeners recognize, the biggest issue, the biggest hurdle has been Hegel's supposed anti-Israel stance. After all, Israel was mentioned some 200 times almost during his nomination hearings, as opposed to just a handful of mentions of Afghanistan, where we are actually in the middle of a war.
I think you said 20 mentions.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I think you said 20 mentions of Afghanistan in your column.
Right. Yeah, about 20 mentions of Afghanistan, exactly, as opposed to, I think, something like 160 mentions of Israel. So I don't think that you need to jump to any kind of great conclusions to admit that the biggest hurdle seems to be right now Hegel's supposed anti-Israel stance, which I personally think is just a farce.
Yeah, so let's dig into that a little bit more, because what seems sort of ironic is that in Washington right now, having a radical stance on Israel and in the Middle East seems to mean that you actually just publicly and vocally support what actual U.S. foreign policy is, which is in support of a two-state solution, opposed to settlement expansion, and for a kind of negotiated settlement along the 67 lines. Now, in the first part of the Bush, in the first Obama term, there was some push initially to halt settlements. That didn't go so well. And then they sort of backed off of it. Do you think that this pick of Hagel signifies that we're going to see something different along those lines in the second term?
I do think that the choice of Hagel for defense secretary does indicate a new strategy towards Israel. And I think it's important to understand this because President Obama is not a fool. He obviously knew that in picking Chuck Hagel that he was picking a bit of a fight with Senate Republicans and with the pro-Israel community in D.C. I mean, he would have to have been quite ignorant to not realize that that was going to happen. So the only logical conclusion is that he did so because he was sending a message. And I think many in the foreign policy establishment recognize what that message is. It's not a turn away from Israel. It's by no means an attempt to downgrade or diminish America's relationship with Israel. But it is a recognition that the interests of Israel and the interests of the United States are no longer quite in alignment in the way that they were in the past. On the contrary, in a lot of cases, the interests of the United States and the interests of Israel actually clash. And, you know, the great sin, as you know, that Chuck Hagel committed was in vocally saying that the United States interests come first, that he is a representative of the United States, that he takes an oath to the American Constitution, not the Israeli Constitution. There actually is no Israeli Constitution, but you know what I mean.
Right.
Yeah. But that in the notion that a senator or an ex-senator and soon to be member of the administration would vocally state that his loyalty, that his concern is first and foremost to the United States, and that there are times in which the interests of the United States and the interests of Israel do not align. And in those cases, obviously, you know, the pursuit of America's interests are paramount. Now, that seems a fairly logical statement. In fact, it would seem a statement that all Americans would want their representative to say, that they look at their interests first and foremost, which is why I think the overwhelmingly hostile reaction that Chuck Hagel's statements have had, particularly amongst Republicans, but also some Democrats like Chuck Schumer in Washington, D.C., has been greeted with, well, frankly, mockery. If any of your listeners got a chance to see the unaired SNL skit fun of the nomination hearings, I mean, that, you know, it was obviously satire, but satire is based on truth. I think most Americans are scratching their heads about the sort of ridiculous response that Chuck Hagel has had to what I think, again, most Americans would recognize as fairly logical, reasonable statement.
So expanding on that a bit, what besides the kind of continued building of settlements, which I think anybody who has any type of interest in a two-state solution, if people still think that that's viable, would see as a direct impediment to the peace process, that being obviously a clear conflict. What beyond that is an area today that you would say there is a clear strategic divergence between the United States and Israel, even sort of beyond the settlement issue?
Well, obviously, the settlement, as has been repeatedly noted by thousands of Israeli politicians, defense ministers, Mossad, Shin Bet officers, the settlements are a policy that it has been, frankly, deliberately designed to ward off the possibility of a two-state solution. I mean, when the Oslo Accords were signed in 1993, essentially laying out the framework for a two-state solution, a safe and secure Israel living side by side with an economic and politically viable Palestine, there were about 100,000 Israeli settlers in the land that Oslo more or less designated to be the future Palestinian state. You know, 2.5 decades of peace processes and accords and declarations and quartets and everything else that you can imagine, roadmaps, and that number is now 500,000. So I think it's important to understand, and frankly, this again, in the United States, seems to be somewhat heretical to say, but the Israeli public, the Israeli politicians, the Knesset, the ruling members of the Israeli government have all made this very clear, that the settlements have been, for the last 4 decades or so, a deliberate policy on the part of successive Israeli governments to, as they themselves put it, create facts on the ground. Those facts on the ground are meant to essentially ward off a final solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict for as long as possible in order to maintain a permanent presence on the Palestinian land. And frankly, the proof is in the pudding. I mean, the fact of the matter is that currently the biggest sticking point to the possibility of a two-state solution is the so-called 67 borders, and the biggest impediment, of course, is the Herculean effort, if not impossible effort, to either remove these settlements or to create some kind of equitable land swap that would still allow for some sort of viable Palestinian state. And not only does that seem like a very difficult, if not, as I say, impossible task, but it's one that the political establishment, certainly the ruling Likud party, has shown no appetite to even discuss, let alone implement.
Right. Well, I think what's interesting is if you read statements from Israeli politicians, you'll either hear from people like an Ehud Olmert, a warning that the settlements are destroying the possibility of a two-state solution, or members of Likud and other far-right parties that are emerging, a statement of reality that they are committed to never having a one-state, two-state solution happen. So, you know, I think you're right. Yes. There is much more public knowledge.
And I think that's actually – you bring up a very good point, Michael, because the fact that now you're hearing both from the left and the right that the settlement – not just the settlements that are already there, but settlement policy, the ongoing construction of settlements in the occupied territories is something that is not going to be halted. It's not going to be reversed. And so, again, from the right and the left, you're hearing the same thing, that this is amounting to there is a consensus emerging to the detriment of the state of Israel that these settlements are going to ultimately lead to a single unified state, what the right in the Israeli spectrum calls the annexing of Judea and Samaria, and what the left is referring to as a binational state. Either way, we are talking about a suicidal policy that is going to ultimately lead to the end of the possibility of a Jewish majority state.
Right. So once again, the point being that actually the sort of best thing you could do as a friend of Israel is to really be aggressive in asserting that this expansion needs to stop. So just sort of pivoting here as we move into the final section of the interview, do you think that the Hegel nomination also signals the possibility of a different approach to Iran, or a different emphasis in terms of striking some type of deal with Iran in the second term? Do you think that's possible, and do you think that that's on President Obama's mind as he picks Senator Hegel for Secretary of Defense?
Yes, well, actually, I think it's important to understand, both with regard to Iran and with regard to Israel, that the policy is going to be set by President Obama, not by the Secretary of Defense. However, in this case, I don't think that there's that much daylight between Secretary or presumptive Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel and President Obama when it comes to how to deal with Iran. I mean, obviously, Obama, especially during the elections, was forced into making certain statements that were very hawkish, very robust about what he is willing to do to keep Iran from developing a nuclear weapon. Occasionally, his statements sounded as though they were coming directly out of the mouth of Benjamin Netanyahu. But if you look at the way that that the president has actually, in a very sober-minded way, dealt with the difficulty of Iran's nuclear ambition, he has never really wavered from his commitment to negotiations and to a diplomatic solution. And I think that's precisely what Secretary Hagel would say. And in fact, in some of his discussions that he's gotten in some trouble for, when he has talked about the fact that sanctions are not helping the situation, that they are not stopping Iran from pursuing its nuclear ambitions, he's absolutely right about that. I don't know who could actually argue with that statement. Mm-hmm. Iran is further along the nuclear trajectory than it's ever been, and sanctions don't seem to be slowing it down in the slightest. And that the only path forward is a negotiated settlement. I don't see President Obama disagreeing with that. So I think that perhaps what this does is it creates a better runway for the president to deal with the Iran situation. But frankly, that's a situation that is as much a hostage to Iranian internal politics as it is to American internal politics. Iran, as you know, is in the middle of a presidential election. The elections will take place in June, but it's also in a place where it's more fractured politically than it has ever been. There is incredible infighting, unprecedented infighting within the Iranian establishment, between the president and the parliament, between the president and the supreme leader. And so in a time in which Iran seems to be deeply, deeply fractured along political lines and preparing for an election that's going to be the first presidential election since the revolution of 2009, as the supreme leader himself said, Iran is not in the mood right now for direct negotiations. I don't think that we should expect anything to happen until after June. But after June, once Iran feels a little bit more comfortable, a little bit more stable, then I think you've got some opening for serious negotiations, because as you sort of rightly mentioned, you know, a lot of the sticky issues are more or less agreed upon. I mean, the United States is going to have to confirm Iran's right to enrich uranium, probably to either 3.5 or 5%. In exchange for more intrusive observations of Iran's nuclear program, the fact that Iran has signed its additional protocols under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty but has not actually implemented them. And then we're going to have some conversation about the removal of sanctions and perhaps the opening up of trade between Iran and the United States. Everybody knows what has to happen. It's just getting the political will on both sides to do it.
Right. So just as one kind of final question to sort of maybe go a little bit deeper into Iranian domestic politics. I think a lot of people had a different image of Iran during the Green Movement of 2009, and whether or not that was informed or accurate or not. People were very inspired by those images and the leadership demonstrated by people like Mousavi and others. And I'm just wondering if you could give an update on where are those leaders still under house arrest or detained? And in this next election, I understand there's a lot of conflict. Is there what we might call a reformist option, or are most of those sort of kind of factional fighting that reflects maybe less of an ideological divergence, if that makes sense?
Very, very good question. Yes, the leaders of the Green Movement, Mousavi, Karoubi, are still under house arrest. Their children are still being harassed. But even the people sort of in the center, people like Ayatollah Rafsanjani, mm-hmm. Have been silenced. His children have been repeatedly arrested and harassed. What that indicates is that there's a misconception in the United States that the Green Movement is dead, that the opposition in Iran has been silenced. Well, if that's the case, then there wouldn't be so much effort on the part of the regime to continue to harass, oppress, arrest, and even in some cases kill those people who were linked to the Green Movement. The regime still sees this as a huge threat. They are far more worried about internal opposition than they are about an Israeli strike or American belligerence. Those things are secondary. As a matter of fact, those things are welcomed. I mean, the only thing that this regime can really hang its hat on to make sure that it maintains a sense of loyalty from the population is the threat of external force. But I think that insofar as electoral politics go, what you're going to see probably, this is my guess, in June, is you're going to see the reformists kind of bow out of this one. Yes, there will be some reformist candidates who will be allowed to run. But I don't think that you're going to see the overwhelming turnout that we saw in 2009. As a matter of fact, I think it's become pretty clear that the Supreme Leader Khamenei has decided that he's going to keep a much closer eye on the presidential elections. He does not want another Ahmadinejad. Ahmadinejad has been nothing but a headache for the Supreme Leader. He's been brought up for impeachment 3 times. He has overtly challenged the Supreme Leader's control over the Iranian government. And I think that Khamenei, the Supreme Leader, has made it very clear that the next president is going to be somebody that he handpicks this time. But nevertheless, in a sense, at least when it comes to the hope of negotiations with Iran, that might not be such a bad thing, because the more confident the Supreme Leader feels in his control over the Iranian government, the more open he will be to serious negotiations on the nuclear program. But the less control he has, the less open he will be. Now, that doesn't mean that it's going to be very good for the Iranian people themselves. I think they are in a situation now where they're going to feel even more constricted by the Supreme Leader's grip over that country. But from the American perspective, the upcoming sham elections that we're about to witness may not be such a bad thing in right. trying to at least get the Iranians to the negotiating table to honestly, openly talk about their nuclear program.
Oh, that's very interesting. And Ahmadinejad apparently annoys everybody. And for a lot of these really complicated issues,
he sure does.
We sort of know where we need to go, but it's a question of how we kind of move past the nonsense and get there. Reza Aslan, adjunct fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, thank you so much, and talk to you soon.
Thank you. Take care.
That was my interview with Reza Aslan, folks. A lot of interesting things happening in the Middle East. Just have one more story to get to before we switch off here. Over the weekend, Nancy Pelosi was interviewed by Candy Crowley on CNN. And she basically, in the strongest terms I've heard her use in a very long time, came out really, really strongly against raising the Medicare eligibility age. That's obviously really important and positive in and of itself. But I think the way she framed why she opposes it, in addition to the policy consequences, but the political consequences and the political reasons why she would oppose it, was also really important. So let's just play that sound. And I'll elaborate on it in a second.
And strengthen these institutions, these pillars of economic and health security for the great middle class, which is the backbone of our democracy. It's all about the middle class. So let's sit down and do that. If the point of it is to take trophies, let's raise the age. That doesn't save money. It's a trophy. It's a scalp. But it's not a solution. And so that we wouldn't be engaged. Raising the age, I am very much against.
So you heard that, folks. I think that's so important to just reemphasize. There is no, as anybody listens to, you know, Sam every day, I'm sure knows, there's no actual fiscal policy benefit to raising the Medicare age. It just shifts the burden onto you. It creates more space in the insurance market, and it puts more pressure on middle class families and working class families. So the policy merits are not there. The real merits for Republicans are, as Nancy Pelosi said, it's claiming the scalp.
in reversing the social safety net. And that would be the purpose of raising the Medicare age. So I think it was great that she, you know, she, a couple months ago, she actually entertained that idea when President Obama floated it. Although the administration's kind of walked back on that position as well. And I think the way that she framed both that it's bad policy and the only real reason we do this is for a political win for Republicans shows that she's thinking smartly and she's got some real commitment on this issue, which hopefully we'll see continued because obviously, if anything, we should lower Medicare eligibility to save money and give more people quality health insurance. We're going to switch up in a second to Matt Binder. Give us a moment. Going to get some music on. And we're going to switch. So stay tuned, folks. Thanks.
All right, folks. Thank you very much, Michael. That was very good.
Pleasure.
Bring yourself up. Can't hear you.
I'm up, buddy.
All right, cool. Just having a little bit of problems hearing over here.
Oh, you can't hear?
No, I'm...
All right.
Am I up by that? The arrow?
You are up by the arrow.
All right. Okay, cool. You can bring it just a tad bit down and we're perfect. Perfect.
Awesome. Okay.
All right. Before we get to the better half, I thought this was a really funny story that we should get to. And by funny, I mean very, very funny. Well, first, I have to hand it to Larry O'Connor over at Breitbart.com for this amazing scoop. I mean, this really is something. Apparently, Paul Krugman, who Larry O'Connor describes here as the economic darling of the left, has filed for Chapter 13 bankruptcy protection. Krugman, according to Larry O'Connor over at Breitbart.com, has been the leading advocate for increased deficit spending as the only solution to turn the U.S. economy around. However, it seems that those Keynesian things don't really work on the micro level. According to the report, Krugman has racked up debts in the millions. The Nobel Prize-winning economist owes $7.35 million, while assets to his name came in at only $33,000. Now, this would be incredible. This would be quite the scoop. It would be amazing for this Larry O'Connor, editor at large over at Breitbart.com, if only this story wasn't reported by satirical news website The Daily Current. I mean, really now. Breitbart.com, this is from Media Matters. Breitbart.com has ridiculed Paul Krugman for filing the Chapter 13 bankruptcy protection and has since deleted the post. Larry O'Connor has jabbed Krugman for spending $84,000 in 1 month, apparently, on Portuguese wines and a dress from the Victorian period.
He just has he looks like something out of like,
he's it's
like
amazing.
Sitting in like a model Versailles house, like, being like, therefore we should have more stimulus. It's, like, I don't get how they're vibing that off of Krugman. He doesn't seem like that to me.
This alone would be great. This alone would be great, that them sourcing this from a satirical news website, the Daily Current, except for the this gets even better.
Yeah.
Because for the fact that the Breitbart team laid into the Washington Post just last month when the Washington Post website accidentally ran a story from the Daily Current about Sarah Palin moving, I believe it was Sarah Palin going to Al Jazeera. And Breitbart blogger John Nolte said that the Washington Post is without a shred of self-awareness, integrity, or dignity. He continued that Washington Post never lets facts get in the way of a good narrative.
It's just you
can't make this up.
Well, that's really the problem with the modern right, is like, how can you even make fun of them anymore? They do it all themselves. But actually, Paul Krugman did have a pretty good idea about how to handle this. So,
oh yes, Paul Krugman.
Yeah, get to how Krugman handled this.
Krugman put in his posted a blog post this morning on his page on the New York Times website, and he said it's titled Breitbarted, and he said, "Okay, I'm an evil person, and my scheming has paid off." On Friday, this is too good. On Friday, I started hearing from friends about a fake story making rounds about my allegedly filing for bankruptcy. I even got asked about the story by a reporter from Russian television, who was very embarrassed when I told him it was fake. But I decided not to post anything about it. Instead, I wanted to wait and see which right-wing media outlets would fall for the hoax. And Breitbart.com came through! He knew! It wasn't even, let's see who falls for this. Knowing even the Washington Post, a mainstream outlet, fell for it. He didn't go, you know, let's just have fun. He knew a right-wing outlet would go for this.
Of course. Of course.
Wait, he continues. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have to go give a lavishly paid speech to friends of Hamas.
That's it.
This is gold. I mean, can the right-wing news websites from the Daily Caller refusing to believe that someone paid the prostitute to lie about Menendez, to Breitbart themselves making up the story about friends of Hamas, and then refusing to admit it was true because their source said it was true. We didn't lie because our source said it was true. I wonder if Larry O'Connor, editor at large over at Breitbart, is going to say, I mean, technically, the Daily Current was our source, and you know they're not saying the story wasn't true.
That's right.
So I mean,
so we stand by it.
We stand by what our source said. It doesn't matter whether it's true or not. What our source said. That's what matters.
Say, look, I want to help out Breitbart.com because I feel bad for them because things haven't been good so good for them recently. So, look, as everybody knows, all of us here at the Majority Report are plugged into the broader liberal, communist, socialist, Muslim conspiracy. And I have a little bit of inside information, which I guess I'm on record saying this, but, you know, you can – however you want to quote me, anonymous source, whatever, it doesn't matter. Basically, Paul Krugman had filed for bankruptcy. That's actually true. And what we realized, and George Soros called an emergency conference call to cover this.
We were on the phone because, as you know, the Majority Report is about 90% funded by George Soros.
George Soros. Yes. Also, and King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia. Oh,
yes.
Whoa, I shouldn't have said that. That was not on public record.
Sam won't be happy about that one.
Sam will not be happy when he has to go fly to Jeddah to get chewed out by the king. But anyways, look. So Soros said, look. Here's what we'll do. I'll cover all of Paul's debts for like silk costumes and Portuguese wine. And what we'll do is I'll funnel the money through Friends of Hamas, where he can give a lecture to that group later today. And so Friends of Hamas is also real. That's how the money from Soros got funded to Krugman. And the conspiracy is even darker than you thought.
I forgot about this small selection from the piece. Among a list of Krugman's creditors, there is a open collection of $33,000 from Tiffany's.
I like that. Looks like Paul Krugman sounds like they think he's like Tony Soprano or something. He's like buying like diamond rocks for his wife. It's just very not Krugman.
It's just amazing, and I mean, It doesn't get any better than that today, at least.
Krogman looks like the type of guy who still packs like a tuna salad sandwich, you know, a tuna fish sandwich for himself. Like,
oh,
he doesn't
yes,
seem like a
yes,
very lavish dude, you know. Yeah.
Well, until apparently he takes his packed tuna fish sandwich and walks past a Tiffany's window and can't help himself.
Control himself. And then he gets into an armored Hummer, which has been leased to him by Soros. All right, this is just a lot.
Let's go into the better half. I don't think there's any better way to end today's freebie show.
There is no better way. Actually, the best way, though, to end the better half is if you are not a member and you're sitting here right now and you're thinking about Sam's new son, you're thinking about Saul Arthur Cedar, you're thinking about how entertainingly, if a bit too loudly, that story was delivered to you because we were a little giddy over it. It happens. And you sit there and you say to yourself, you know what? I think I want to become a member. I think I want to support this show. I think I want to help keep independent media alive, help Sam feed his family, keep them clothed. And obviously, and this kid's going to need, like, clearly he'll need, like, guitar and gutter lessons, obviously.
With a name with a name like Saul, he might need a lot more.
Yeah, he's going to need therapy. He's going to need – there's a lot of costs built into this that go far beyond just college. So please, become a member. Go to our Amazon link. What else can people do?
They could subscribe to us on YouTube, youtube.com/Sam Cedar. They can subscribe to us on iTunes. Just open up your iTunes and search for the Majority Report in the iTunes store. It is free to subscribe to us on the iTunes store. What else? They could donate their Facebook and Twitter accounts at donateyouraccount.com. If you want to interact with us in the members portion of the show, the better half, you could IM us at Majority FM and on your AIM machine, or you can call in 646-257-3920. That is 646-257-3920. Those phone lines will be open shortly, and let's go into the better half of the program.